you for joining our CMS Lessons from the Frontlines on COVID-19 today, May 22nd. We'd like to begin by thanking all of you for the work you are doing day in and day out to care for patients around the nation amidst COVID-19. This is Alina Chekai leading stakeholder engagement in the Office of CMS Administrator Seema Verma. And today's call is part of our ongoing series, Lessons from the Frontlines. And while members of the press are always welcome to attend these calls, we do ask that they please refrain from asking questions. All press and media questions can be submitted using our media inquiries form, which can be found online at cms.gov/newsroom. Any non-media COVID-19 related questions for CMS can be directed to our COVID mailbox, which is covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. Here at CMS, we recognize that government's role during COVID-19 is to offer maximum flexibility and regulatory relief to allow you all to do what you do best, care for the patients in your local communities. Around the nation, providers and local communities are innovating in response to COVID-19. And at CMS, we hope to bring local innovators together to share best practices that can be scaled at the national level. Today's call will focus on these expanded flexibilities, and we will hear from providers who are seizing the opportunity to innovate and transform to support their communities. Today, we will hear from providers regarding COVID-19 therapeutics, and we also have a special segment on communicating and caring for patients with serious illness. We do encourage you to direct your questions to our guest speakers on the line, and should you have more technical questions on CMS waivers and guidance, we encourage you to join our CMS office hours, which are held every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern. And this week we are joined by FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn and Deputy Commissioner for Medical and Scientific Affairs Dr. Anand Shah for an update on COVID-19 therapeutics. In addition, we are also joined by two physicians from the field who have offered to share their perspectives and best practices for therapeutics during this time. But first, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Hahn.
Thank you, Alina. And I also want to echo the thanks to all of you for being on this call. As we move forward against this unprecedented global pandemic, we do continue to see signs of progress and promise. But really, that's due to the great efforts of the providers on this phone, as well as others around the globe. So thank you very much for everything that you're doing. At FDA, we recognize the urgency of getting products, tests, treatments, and vaccines to patients and doctors. But we also recognize that this is a balance that we have to achieve, that all of our decision-making must be made upon data and science. As physicians, we realize that at times, the data and science, the information we have in treating a patient may be imperfect, yet we are responsible at FDA for making decisions in that context. We're certainly committed to helping foster the development of safe and effective medical treatments. That's a gold standard that we uphold, but also providing regulatory advice and guidance and technical assistance to developers, something that we've done throughout the COVID-19 pandemic and outbreak. We've provided significant and, frankly, unprecedented regulatory flexibility and streamlined processes where needed and appropriate to facilitate the development of new treatments. We have developed something called the Coronavirus Treatment Acceleration Program, which allows us to prioritize those therapies with the highest scientific backing and allowing those to go into clinical trial or to apply for emergency use authorization. We definitely want and emphasize that the data that come from well-performed controlled clinical trials will provide us with the absolute best information to allow us to move forward. We're working with many different drug manufacturers as well as academic centers, and we've provided guidance and technical expertise to expedite the clinical trials. More than 90 drugs are being studied, and we are working with a number of vaccine sponsors. You may know that we've authorized Safe to Proceed for 3 of those vaccines to go into clinical trials, and some have already done so. There are more than 144 clinical trials that have been initiated for therapeutic agents for COVID-19, and we recently issued an emergency use authorization for remdesivir, That particular antiviral agent had been used in other viral diseases before. It was taken off the shelf and in frankly record time went through a randomized clinical trial in hospitalized patients with results showing that it reduced time to recovery. And there was a trend, although not statistically significant, toward improvement in mortality. The data is still mature from that trial, but we felt that they were sufficient to go forward with an emergency use authorization for that drug, remdesivir. We also need to get these data more quickly, and so we've looked at how clinical trials are designed, how we can be innovative about those, but also how we can use real-world evidence. The evidence that you all in the front line are at and how the data from the medical records might better inform and more quickly inform our decisions. We need to be transparent about the information and evidence that's available. FDA is committed to being transparent about that and to acknowledge when the data are incomplete, but we're in a position where we need to make a decision about an authorization. Certainly, the recent information we provided about the safety of hydroxychloroquine and about some of the testing equipment that we previously authorized is evidence of the fact that we must absolutely share data as it comes to us. I'm confident moving forward that as we gain more answers and treatments, we'll be able to apply the lessons not from this, but for future health challenges as well. Dr. Shaw, my deputy here at FDA, and I are totally committed with transparency around that process and constant continuous improvement. Thank you very much for allowing me to participate, and we're both very happy to answer questions. Alina, back to you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll now turn it over to Dr. Anand Shah, the Deputy Commissioner for Medical and Scientific Affairs at the FDA.
Thank you, Alina, and thank you, Dr. Han. I'll just offer a few additional remarks about some of the developments in therapeutics and also offer a few comments about progress on a vaccine. But first, I want to start with a brief mention of another important area we've made some significant progress in, and that's testing. As all of you know, there's been a special emphasis on the development and availability of accurate and reliable tests for COVID-19. Quite simply, we need to know who has the disease and who's previously had it. This is essential if we're going to understand this virus and return to a more normal lifestyle and start to reopen the economy. Since January, we've worked with hundreds of test developers, many of whom who have submitted emergency use authorization requests to FDA for tests that detect the virus and its antibodies. Today, we have a number of reliable tests on the market, and we're constantly strengthening it with updated data and evidence. I also want to mention the FDA's work in support of the effort to facilitate the development of and access to two investigational therapies derived from human blood, convalescent plasma and hyperimmune globulin. These two antibody-rich blood products, they're made from blood donated by people who have recovered from the virus, and they're being studied to determine if they could shorten the length or even lessen the severity of the illness. Dr. Han has already spoken about some of our work in support of the development of therapeutics. I'll say that there are a variety of therapeutic areas being evaluated for COVID-19 patients. That includes antiviral drugs and immunotherapies that might be helpful in reducing lung inflammation and improving lung function. I also want to mention that FDA is supporting Operation Warp Speed, which is the cross-governmental effort to expedite the development and availability of therapeutics and vaccines to combat COVID-19. On vaccines, this is an important and exciting area for many reasons, not the least of which is that ultimately, of course, a vaccine is the most likely way that we'll eventually defeat this disease. As we work towards this goal of an approved, safe, and effective vaccine, FDA is providing regulatory advice, guidance, and technical assistance to advance its development and availability. We're working closely with federal partners, large and small vaccine developers, researchers, manufacturers, and experts across the globe to explore, expedite, and incentivize the most efficient and timely development of vaccines by exploring all possible options. A number of experimental designs are currently under consideration, and we're working collaboratively with manufacturers to move products forward while ensuring that we have the safety and efficacy data needed to meet FDA standards. The process we're using is a dynamic one. It's continually informed by new data and evidence, very similar to the approach that we've been using in the search for therapeutic treatments. And as Dr. Hahn regularly states, the search for new products is an ongoing process that relies on research and data to continually evaluate and reevaluate whether treatments are safe and effective through a careful and necessary balancing of risks and benefits. I want to take a moment and thank CMS for hosting Dr. Hahn and I on today's call. We really appreciate the opportunity to have a two-way dialogue with all of you on the front lines. And with that, I'll pass it back to CMS.
Thank you, Dr. Shah. I'm now pleased to introduce our guest speakers today, who are national leaders addressing COVID-19 therapeutics and treatment. First, I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Magdalena Sobachek. She is the Chief of Infectious Disease at New York Presbyterian Columbia University. Dr. Sobachek, over to you.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you so very much for letting me join you this afternoon and for the opportunity just to share some thoughts and lessons learned from the front lines and from practitioners here in New York City. I just wanted to sort of say that it's been an amazing experience to also sort of have the opportunity to communicate with many providers from across the country through a variety of calls that have been organized in many settings through the CDC and other government agencies and public private partnerships, because I think it's such an exchange of ideas that really helps us make sure that we have the best resources available in terms of education, training, and access to research to benefit our patients and our providers. So I just wanted to make a few thoughts and comments that are just about some of the questions that, as we know, are sort of facing clinicians and researchers, and as we are treating our patients at the front lines. I think, and that's also sort of what's driving many of the research questions that are informing the clinical trial. So one of the key questions that we as providers face is, you know, what do we target with therapeutics, the virus or the host response to the virus that we know this can be a devastating inflammatory response that can be seen both sort of in the mid stage and in the delayed stage of the disease. We are still sort of learning a lot about what determines the rapidity and progression of the disease, and there are many clinical trials that are trying to address that as well, and the optimal timing in which to intervene on a patient is also a key question that's facing both the practitioners and clinicians as well as researchers. I think, as we all know, the framework and the key issue in providing care to our patients is providing them with the supportive care in terms of oxygenation and ventilatory and support, and then the therapeutics that are being investigated in clinical trials and or through emergency use authorization have really revolutionized the way we think about COVID-19. I have to say that clinical trials are certainly evaluating the different treatment strategies, as was mentioned previously. I have to say, and I think many would agree, that conducting these clinical trials in the midst of a pandemic is both a challenge, an amazing opportunity, and a great privilege. The field is certainly learning a lot, and we as practitioners are learning a lot through the clinical trials we are conducting and pivoting very quickly based on the results of these well-conducted randomized clinical studies. And so as you heard and as you all know, with thanks to the emergency use authorization of remdesivir, which is not FDA approved yet, but has been made available, it's really changed our approach to therapeutics here at the front lines. The other issue that many of us are still, and researchers and clinicians are grappling with, is how to modify the host response and think about kind of immune modulation that is an important component of COVID-19 disease. And there are agents that are being evaluated, such as cytokine inhibitors, that are being evaluated in the context of clinical trials. that are going to yield incredibly important information. And because COVID-19 has been, as we know, has been associated with this profound inflammation as well as a prothrombotic state with increase in fibrin degradation products, fibrinogen, and the D-dimer levels, there's also sort of a lot of attention that's being it's being paid both in clinical setting and in research to modulating those events. And even though we don't really truly know what the true incidence of thrombosis is in these settings, there have been reports of thromboembolic disease that have been seen in COVID-19 patients, and we certainly are seeing that in patients in intensive care units, kind of these microangiopathic events and prothrombotic events that contribute to the increased mortality and morbidity of these patients. And so while there are still many questions that remain about the role of coagulation markers and the complement pathway and the role of thrombolytic and anticoagulants and antiplatelet agents and complement inhibitors and what role they play in management of these patients. And I think these questions are being investigated in a very systematic fashion in the context of clinical trials. But those very much will sort of guide kind of the our response to COVID-19 comorbidities and the use of antithrombotic agents for prevention of these venous thromboembolic events. It's certainly being investigated and being used in hospitalized settings and is being evaluated very carefully. And a lot of attention is being paid to careful monitoring and evaluation of hospitalized patients who are at risk for these thrombotic events. So that's sort of been sort of what's been informing a lot of our management recently here at the front lines, kind of these both these acute events as well as the inflammatory prothrombotic events that we know are sequela of this particular viral infection. Let me stop for now, and I'll be happy to take questions during the Q&A session.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sobieszczyk. I'd now like to introduce Dr. Nigeri Wainaina, Associate Professor of Medicine and Surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Wainaina, over to you.
Thank you very much. It truly is an honor and a privilege to participate in this, and I really do appreciate the work that you're doing to bring so many people together so that we can learn from one another as we try and figure out what's the best way forward. And that's what's been our experience over here. Sorry, that's my pager going off, which has now stopped. I apologize for that. We certainly out in the Midwest and in Wisconsin have not seen the numbers of cases that have been seen out in New York. But we've seen very similar patterns and have gone through a similar process, I'd imagine, of trying to figure out who is getting sick, who's getting really sick, how do we predict ahead of time, and then how do we approach the disease. Our initial approach involved, you know, going through all the literature as it was coming out at record pace and trying to provide the best guidance for our clinicians at the front line, whether it was in the clinics, in our emergency department, or in the hospital. And one of the things that we've gained from that is developing a true multidisciplinary approach, recognizing that none of us had the answer, and all of us had to be nimble and closely observing what was going on. So we've really been able to develop excellent partnership between our pulmonary and critical care docs, our cardiologists, our hematologists, the infectious disease group of whom I am a part, and our hospitalists as well as our outpatient clinicians as we think about the spectrum of care. Nobody really has the answers as to what what's the best way to treat? Should we be using an antiviral approach? Should we be using more of a serological approach with convalescent plasma? Should we be addressing the inflammatory response? And it's probably a bit of all of those depending on where the patient is at what time. So one thing we are certain of is that supportive care is the foundation of taking care of these patients, providing the oxygenation and ventilatory support as needed. But as important is identifying which patients may be able to get better on their own without necessarily being in the hospital, which, you know, turned out to be the majority. But you know, constantly watching who we have and how they're doing was really our best intervention, and the ability to be nimble and adjust our approaches as we got more and more information. We're privileged to be able to participate and continue to enroll in different clinical trials so that we can get the best possible information as to what truly works and who it works in, as opposed to just relying 100% on our initial impressions, recognizing that we have individual biases. I think I'll stop my comments at that and return to CMS, and I'm happy to take questions as well.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wynine. I really appreciate your perspective. Operator, let's open up the phone for some questions focused on therapeutics for either the FDA or our guest speakers today. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have questions, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Our first question is from Edward Yu of Featherheld. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate these calls. My question is about the vaccine development. What we would like to learn more is there are a multitude of companies internationally going into this. What is the governmental agencies going to do to help us to sort through among those that are going to hit the market? How do we know which one works the best? We have that issue now with antibody testing and antigen testing test, and we just want to make sure that when we get to the vaccine treatment stage that we have some way of determining which of these products will be the most effective one. Thank you.
This is Steve Hahn from the FDA. That's a really excellent question. As you can imagine, there is a difference between the vaccines and the antibody tests with respect to the number and the different operating characteristics. Nonetheless, your point about the fact that some vaccines may have a different level of efficacy than others is spot on. Certainly from our point of view at FDA, when we issue an approval or an authorization, and that is not yet known what will happen, obviously it will depend upon the data, we will use the data that we receive to provide guidance with respect to the indication, which patients, how often to give it, and at what times. And so that will be part of our either authorization or approval process. Very similar to what we did with remdesivir, where we specified the patient population that the authorization applied to. So we will do the same with the vaccines. we will likely receive applications from a number of different vaccine makers, and that will be one of our jobs as we sort through the data that they provide us. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
The next question is from Tracy Russell of Canyon Home Care. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I had a question about the thrombolytic events that you guys are seeing, and considering that we work in home care and we work with the elderly, which are the most highly affected people, is there anything that we can do in a preventative way? Should we be managing their blood levels to assure appropriate clotting factors in case of infection or anything like that?
So if I may, this is Magda Sobieszczyk, if I may answer that question and others can weigh in as well. So I think it's an excellent question. And as we sort of mentioned, many patients with COVID-19 actually do have, you know, sort of a mild disease course, which may not necessitate hospitalization, in which case we actually don't even see these patients in the hospital, but you're probably managing them from afar. Current recommendations in terms of monitoring and laboratory testings are that for individuals who are not hospitalized but who do have COVID-19, there are really no data that would support checking and monitoring levels of D-dimers or platelet counts of fibrinogen. That's a little bit different in individuals who are hospitalized, just because these markers are oftentimes measured in the course of their hospitalization. But there are really, and this is this has been discussed through by experts in the field, and has sort of coalesced into the guidance that's being provided by the NIH in terms of there's really no evidence to support the necessity for measuring of these coagulation markers. But I think advising patients about taking kind of the usual precautions as we do in sick individuals, and making sure sort of remaining ambulatory to the extent possible would be prudent. And I hope others can weigh in as well.
This is Jerry Wainaina. I would agree with that in the outpatient setting with mild disease, there really is no role for treatment or for any prophylaxis outside of what the patient usually would be on. Many of these patients are likely to be on a baby aspirin for primary or secondary prophylaxis of their chronic medical conditions. For patients who are coming back to the nursing home or being newly admitted to the nursing home after having been in the hospital with COVID, there may be a group that are higher risk that may have required prophylaxis against venous thromboembolism or this thromboembolic phenomenon. And there's even a smaller group that's really high risk that have been treated and may continue with therapeutic anticoagulation when they come out. Other than those groups, it would basically be their routine treatment, their routine aspirin, for instance, and any other anticoagulants they may be on. And, of course, emphasis on ambulation, both for prophylaxis against thromboembolism and to get them to treat the deconditioning they may have from having been in the hospital.
Thank you for your question. And thank you again, Commissioner Hahn and Deputy Commissioner Shaw, for joining us, as well as our terrific guest speakers today. We will move to our next segment, which is focused on communicating and caring for patients with serious illness. And today we are joined by providers in the field, as well as patient advocates who are going to speak to this topic today. And I'm also joined by a number of my CMS colleagues who will offer their expert perspectives throughout the conversation as well. And joining me from the agency is Dr. Marion Couch, Senior Medical Advisor to Administrator Seema Verma, Dr. Michelle Schreiber, Director of the Quality Measurement and Value-Based Incentives Group at the Center for Clinical Standards and Quality at CMS, Dr. Barry Marks, Director of the Office of Clinician Engagement, and Dr. Michael Lipp, Chief Medical Officer at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And moderating this segment is Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter. She is the founder of the EndWell Foundation, and she is passionate about improving how people are cared for throughout the continuum of life, which we know is especially important during these unprecedented times. Dr. Ungerleiter, pleased to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Alina. I appreciate you having me and the rest of my colleagues. So as you mentioned, I'm an internist and the founder of EndWell, and we're a nonprofit really focused on transforming the culture, the care, the policy and perceptions around how we address the end of life experience, which is, of course, inclusive of serious illness care, death and dying, caregiving, as well as grief and loss. And I'm really pleased to be joining you alongside my colleagues, who you'll hear from shortly. It's critical that during this very challenging time that we consider, you know, how might COVID-19 present new avenues for care? So today we curated this group of experts from across the country who are going to take us through various elements of the patient journey, starting with a serious illness diagnosis. And this ideally starts with access to high-quality palliative care for patients and families facing a life-limiting illness. And in these times and beyond, you know, how can we create the right conditions for telemedicine, given that the circumstances don't always allow for in-person visits? How can we keep the patient experience at the center of the conversation? If a patient becomes hospice eligible, what does that look like during this era of physical distancing? And what are the best practices around providing hospice, whether at home, in a facility or in the hospital? And then finally, the need to address really the provider experience during these unimaginably stressful times is paramount. How can we create a medical culture that supports clinicians when we're experiencing burnout and grief at significant numbers? So our work at EndWell has shown that earlier, better communication with patients and families facing serious illness is not only good for patient outcomes, families also feel more supported, report less trauma, and it, of course, can reduce clinician distress as well. So with that, I'm pleased to introduce you to our first speaker, Dr. Michael Fratkin, a palliative care physician, the CEO and founder of Resolution Care Network. He lives in rural Northern California and is a pioneer in the use of telemedicine for palliative care and how we can best leverage technology to connect with our patients. So with that, Dr. Michael Fratkin, over to you.
Thank you so much, Shoshana. Thank you, Commissioner Hahn and others in the federal government working so hard to figure out what works and what does not work in response to the medical treatment of people with this terrible coronavirus. There's two things I really want to get across today. One is that telemedicine is better than real life and has been, and I'll explain why I think that. And number two, I will also want to emphasize that it's an important element of a rapid community response. So we have been doing palliative care in the home with a team for about 5 years, and what we've discovered with the use of telemedicine is that there are two major directions that make it better than real life. One is that people don't have to do the things that are necessary to deliver themselves as patients to the settings where we've centralized the delivery of healthcare. They don't have to get up in the morning. They don't have to get dressed. They don't have to have a family member take a half a day off of work. They don't have to fight with traffic. They don't have to get through the front door and into the waiting room where they're confronted by other very sick people. And the clipboard and the whole experience of becoming identified as a patient. And they don't have to return themselves to home. All of those practical things are out of their way. As it relates to home-based care, they don't have to deal with an invasion of their home by healthcare professionals with a sort of asymmetrical power structure. What they have to deal with is the click of a link once the technology has been facilitated, and poof, there as a healthcare professional with their attention held and just seeing them. The more subtle aspects of how it's better, I can't really outline in 5 minutes, but I want you to recognize that these technologies are access to leveling of the power structure. And when you're working with people, not to manage what's the matter with them, but to explore what truly matters to them, this window, this framing of the encounter is a whole new setting for healthcare. So I think there's two things that I hope will be durable after this terrible experience we're all going through together. Number one is that telemedicine is here to stay. And number two, that in the face of mortality, that each and every one of us, all the participants in the call, all the speakers, the commissioner, everybody is faced with a threat to their mortality. And my hope is the idea of getting extra person-centered support in that context makes a little bit more sense to people going forward. So palliative care should be elevated in your attention as you think about what the lived experience of serious illness is, and that the telemedicine technologies are adequate and exceptional at providing you access to being there with the people you're caring for in their homes.
Thank you, Michael. I am now pleased to introduce Adam Hayden, who is a writer, a patient advocate, and an organizer for the brain tumor community. Adam was diagnosed with glioblastoma in 2016, and since that time has really become a patient advocate, publishing issues germane to medical education, to survivorship, philosophy of illness, and testifying regularly in Washington, D.C. So with that, Adam, over to you.
Great, terrific. Thanks so much, Dr. Ungerleiter. Thanks to CMS, and thanks also to the FDA. I shared with some organizers leading up to this call that my community, through a nonprofit National Brain Tumor Society, was recently invited to an FDA listening session to hear from the patients that are impacted by brain tumors and central nervous system cancers. And so really hats off to the FDA and to CMS, and of course to all the frontline clinicians gathered today. Hey, so I just want to provide, so as someone who is living with a serious illness, and I should mention my spouse, in fact, is an inpatient occupational therapist. She works for our county hospital where we live, and she is currently recovering from an infection of COVID-19 that she did most likely contract working on the front lines. So this issue is timely and urgent, really, for our family and for the whole community. I just want to share three peaks maybe behind the curtain of the patient experience for those with serious illness. I think dovetailing on some of what Dr. Fratkin just shared, speaking to telemedicine, there's the provider, the clinician experience, but then of course we're curious about the patient experience as well. So I think the first thing of the three points I want to share, the first is that, you know, folks with serious illness, we do possess kind of a special wisdom. And I know that's a bit of a head scratcher for some people, but you know, it is the reality of facing our bodies as they change. And you know, the function we were once used to perhaps is different after treatment or after a serious illness. But through those changes, we begin to pick up, what does matter most? And what is my life really about? And that daily sort of wrestling with our mortality does give us a little bit of wisdom. So I think the first thing to promote here is that the serious illness community, we are interested in being partners through change. I think one of the ways that we've been vocal throughout the advocacy community is to remind folks that certain public health guidelines that are recommended, that it is in your personal interest, but really it is to the benefit of the community that we enact those changes and that we embrace them. And so I think that responsible acceptance of public health recommendations, folks with serious illness, some of the wisdom that we have is to encourage other people to embrace those changes, not to be fearful or intimidated or resistant, but instead to see how acting in responsibility for our communities, it is really one of the most important, meaningful actions that we can take. The second thing that I just wanted to share with everyone is that an extension of that wisdom, but a little bit more on the ground,
that we are good at overcoming obstacles to accessibility. So, of course, in a personal and real life example, after my surgical resection, you know, I had a long road to recovery. I was a wheelchair user immediately following a resection of a pretty big tumor, a 7-centimeter mass in my right parietal lobe. But, you know, graduating from a wheelchair to a walker to a cane, that's sort of a real life overcoming of accessibility obstacles. But, you know, accessing social media, accessing virtual support groups, the serious illness community has been at this for a while. So I think that's another thing just to lift up is that many of the patients that you are interfacing with may already have some experience with using tools like telemedicine or accessing, you know, through Twitter chats or Facebook support groups. There's a vast kind of peer-to-peer support network. And you can tap into those networks. So maybe you don't want to participate. You'd be welcome to, of course. But you can still sort of scroll and troll and find and see. So there are Twitter support communities rallied around disease-specific hashtags. So regardless of your specialty, you may tap into a certain cancer-specific support group, for example. You can locate their hashtag. You can scroll through their Twitter chat timelines. And you can learn the on-the-ground truth from members of the communities that you support. So I think that's important to remember this idea of a physician and patient divide. I think in the realm of technology where we are today, we can help to bridge those gaps and to learn the wisdom that we each and all have to share. I think the third point that I want to make before kind of wrapping up here is just to address the sort of telehealth or telemedicine visit specifically. There are two really common worries that I've heard expressed by members of my community. So this may be helpful for clinicians on the call to understand how they may manage the expectations of the patients during the encounter. I think the first thing that I hear is, you know, is a full exam even possible in this setting? And we know that for many conditions, you know, you need the physical examination. That's very important. I also want to emphasize that touch in the clinical encounter is really reassuring to patients. But knowing that that's not accessible or available to many of us today, the first thing is, can we do a full exam? And in the brain tumor community, you know, you can do things like walk around in front of the webcam to check gait stability. You could, you know, talk to invite partners to the telemedicine visit and, you know, to sort of inquire about changes in memory or behavior, things like that, checking symptom logs. Many caregivers or care partners in our community help to keep a notebook where they track symptoms for their patients. So I think managing expectations, helping to assure our patients that, yes, a full exam is possible when we're conducting this encounter via telemedicine, and to remind patients, there's a terrific neuro-oncologist, Dr. Ashley Summerall, who's involved in our community. She had a really terrific kind of tweet thread talking about, you know, her preparation for the visit, whether that's telemedicine or if that's in the office, her preparation is the same. She goes through the chart. She prepares to meet with the patient. I think that that helps to calm the nerves of patients to know the preparation of the visit, of the encounter, doesn't change just because it's telemedicine. It's just a different mode, but the same care is available. So I think that that's a helpful thing. The final sort of worry that I've heard expressed is that we miss the hugs. So I know not everyone is a hugger, but as I've thought about this, you know, we do need a tactile sensation to sort of come along with us through the virtual encounter. So I've been brainstorming, you know, is it something like a rubbing stone? Is there something that patients may have available to them in their home that can associate a tactile experience with the visit? That may be a way, you know, if we're thinking about surrogate endpoints, we're thinking about surrogate hugs. What's a way to encourage some sort of physical connection to the visit, regardless of the physical barriers that we have by conducting a visit through telemedicine? So those are the three insights I thought. We've got wisdom. We want to share it. Find us on social media. You can learn about the ground truth and then help to manage expectations around the telemedicine visit. So that's it for me. I think I'll turn it back over to Dr. Ungerleiter. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Adam. Our next expert is Dr. Sonali Wilborn. She's the Chief Medical Officer of Heart of Hospice, and she'll share how their team built the first inpatient hospice unit for patients with COVID in New Orleans in just 10 days, and then talk about the importance of creating ways for people to be with their loved ones at the end of life in person or even virtually. So over to you, Dr. Wilborn.
Hey, Shoshana, good afternoon. First of all, thank you for having me on this call, and also thank you to CMS, Beth, and Alina, and the rest of the team for putting together these calls. I think it's incredibly important. What I'd like to do today is really to take a few minutes to address three things. One is to tell you a little bit about what it is that we did at Heart of Hospice and why it was important. The second thing I'd like to talk about is really the impact this is having on our patient population, especially the seriously ill patient population who are institutionalized. And the third thing is really talk a little bit about sort of our long-term hopes and wishes. If there is some good that comes out of the COVID-19 pandemic and all of that we are facing today, talk to you a little bit about what that hope would be. So let me start by telling you real quickly a little bit about our organization. So Heart of Hospice is an experienced hospice and palliative care organization, and we've been in business for several years. We have a pretty significant presence in 5 of the southern states in our country, with the Louisiana market being our largest. We care for over 1,700 patients across our 5 states, and in Louisiana, we care for over 1,000 patients across the state. But the one thing that I will say to you right from the onset of the pandemic, it was not even a question to us that it was important for us as a hospice and palliative care organization to take care of COVID patients. We didn't have a hesitation or a pause, recognizing there was a need to bring end-of-life care to these patients, especially, you know, patients who are frail, elderly, multimorbid patients who are certainly known to have a higher mortality from this disease. So the way that we went about it is that we aggressively created a COVID-19 internal task force that met on a daily basis. And in addition to that, one of the key things that we did, we aggressively sourced PPE so we could keep our staff safe in the event we were able to care for COVID-19 patients. Around the time, this was towards the end of March, what we were noticing in one of our major markets, which was New Orleans, that there was a significant uptick in COVID-19 cases. What we were hearing from our colleagues on the front lines, in the ICUs, hospitalists, we were hearing that the New Orleans hospitals were being inundated with multiple COVID-19 patients. We also heard about the fact that the ERs and the intensive care units were full. Patients who were unlikely to recover from COVID-19 were actually, unfortunately, dying in the hospitals, in the ERs, in the ICUs, on the medical floors, sometimes in waiting rooms, without the benefit and the support of family at the bedside, and certainly without the benefit of hospice and end-of-life support. And what we had also heard, because, you know, we're certainly a part of our community, we've heard from multiple family members who had lost loved ones, and they were clearly traumatized by the experience of not being able to be present during their loved one's final moments. So recognizing this need, on one of our COVID-19 task force calls, we had this crazy idea, and I still remember to this day the date it was. It was April 1st when we floated the idea of putting up what we referred to as a pop-up hospice inpatient unit, which was going to be dedicated to caring for COVID-19 patients, especially COVID-19 patients that were hospitalized and unlikely to recover. So what was incredible about this is that our CEO, Carla Davis, who is extremely forward-thinking, you know, there was a pause in the line when we came up with this crazy idea, and she said, you know, even though this is the craziest idea I've heard, let's go ahead and run with it and see if we can make this happen. Our intent with this pop-up inpatient unit was to ease the burden on the hospital system, free up the beds and the critical resources while bringing true end-of-life care, if you will, and symptom management patients to these patients in a hospital, And to do it in a setting which was similar to a hospital, but with the benefit of hospice providers taking care of them, and also with the benefit of safely allowing family members to be at their bedsides. So once we had this idea and had the go-ahead from our leader, we decided multiple members of the senior leadership team basically started working at it from several different angles. What I will tell you is that we had incredible help and support from the Louisiana State Department, from Palmetto GVA, basically in helping us process through things that normally in a traditional world, the regulatory environment prevents it from happening as quickly as it did. But with the support from these two, you know, from these agencies, what we were able to do is really get licensed. We got our 855 approved, and we had the state walkthrough literally from day one of idea and took our very first patient 14 days after that. What I'd also like to do is recognize that we've had incredible support from the healthcare, from the administration, who have certainly identified that there's need in the healthcare in the community, and has mobilized resources. They've implemented the CARES Act, and with the advocacy of NHPCO, we've had increased telehealth access. We've had the ability to practice across state lines. We've seen the removal of the three-day hospital stay to get patients into nursing homes. So there's been an incredible amount that's been done by the administration to support bringing care to patients out in the community. What I'd like to share with you is that to date, we have cared for 144 COVID-19 positive patients across our communities, and 64 of those patients we actually brought to the inpatient unit and were able to bring end-of-life care to them and allow them to pass in peace and comfort with their family members at the bedside. What has also been incredible about this journey is that we've had over 60 plus staff members from across our different sites who have come to the New Orleans Hospice Inpatient Unit and basically care for these patients, and not one of our staff members has actually become sick or has been exposed to the virus. So PPE certainly works and has been incredible in helping keep our families and our patients and our staff safe. The couple of additional things that I'd like to address before turning the call over back to Shoshana is the impact that COVID-19 has had on patients. You know, we certainly recognize that there's going to be widespread impact, not only on the patients, certainly on families, and certainly significantly on our institutionalized patients who are suffering from COVID-19, not because of the disease itself, but also because of being isolated with the decreased functionality, the greater need for therapy that they're not able to get to, the higher mortality and morbidity that they're impacted with. What we're also seeing, unfortunately, in these instances, because of the way that things are structured, we're seeing hospice and palliative care providers in many instances are not able to get into hospitals and get into nursing homes to care for these patients. This is leading to patients basically dying alone without the support of families and also without the support, oftentimes, of aggressive symptom management, which we certainly see there is a need for. I'd like to close by saying, if there is a few things that we'd like to see happen going forward, is really to continue to have a plan to allow for greater access of hospice and palliative care support in hospitals, nursing homes, where the sickest cohort of our patients reside. I'd also like to see if we can come up with creative ways to actually encourage hospice utilization in the nursing home community, especially for patients who might be COVID-19 positive and are extremely symptomatic, without a negative impact on their reimbursements. We also would want to promote and encourage advanced care planning. As some of my colleagues previously have shared, it is really a patient's right to choose, and now more so than ever, having an advanced care plan, making sure the patient's wishes are addressed and heard, I think is key. I'd like to end and conclude by saying that hospice and palliative care certainly has a larger role to play in caring for patients who are chronically ill, both now when dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, and certainly beyond, especially as it relates to patient outcomes and overall patient experience, I think there's a huge role that we have to play. In conclusion, I'd like to reiterate how incredible it has been to be on this call with the leaders who've spoken on the call before me, leaders of the healthcare system, and how grateful I am for the work that the administration and the rest of you on this call are doing on the front lines to keep our patients and communities safe. With that, Shoshana, I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Our final expert is Dr. Sunita Puri. She is an author and the medical director of the Palliative Medicine and Supportive Care Service at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, where she also serves as the chair of the Ethics Committee. So she'll share why addressing physician distress in the era of COVID is so critical now more than ever. Dr. Sunita Puri, over to you.
Thank you so much, Shoshana, and thank you to CMS and to all of my colleagues in the field of palliative care for the beautiful work you're doing. What I would like to address today actually dovetails nicely with Sonali's comments, but I'd like to shift the focus from patient grief to provider grief. The experience of physician grief amid COVID, how COVID has exposed the grief we have always experienced in medicine, and the lack of rituals for physicians to explore their feelings are the topics I'd like to discuss with you today. I'd also like to suggest from my experience as a writer and author that writing may actually be a useful tool for people to explore their individual grief, which now is less isolating and more deeply connected to the grief of the world. So what is grief? Grief is our reaction to profound loss. And it's not just emotional. It can have really profound physical, cognitive, and spiritual effects as well. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her five stages of grief are what we're taught in medical school to interpret and help people through their own experience of grief. But we don't turn that lens on ourselves. We're not taught to. And even though there are five stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, these don't happen in a linear fashion and may continue to cycle through our lives for a while. Grief is a process. It's something that slowly unfolds, and it can be our companion throughout life, depending on the magnitude of a loss. And although sometimes people feel when they are grieving they are so isolated, because they are grieving something that keeps them stuck while the world is moving forward. And grief can have many permutations. We can feel it from anything from a loss of a relationship to the loss of a parent to, most relevant in this discussion, the loss of a patient. There are so many stories and images in the news these days about how physicians are overwhelmed, traumatized, and grieving patient care, especially when so many patients come into the hospital, often in the later stages of dying of COVID, and that paralyzes us as providers because we're trained to save. We're less capable of contending with what it means to reach the limits of our capabilities in a pandemic that is overwhelming. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the strange silver linings of this pandemic is that it has forced us to reconsider how grief and overwhelm and trauma has always been a part of healthcare providers' experience. And it's been highlighted by this pandemic, both for the public, but also for institutions in our own field, which have not always known how to address and make space for how physicians interpret loss. So in medicine, we are witnessing situations we couldn't have imagined, losing patients quickly, witnessing particular forms of suffering and sudden death, feeling inadequate in our work due to the sheer volume and complexity of patients presenting, and our feelings of depression and anxiety from what is being asked of us. In addition to that, we're trying to support families of patients who can't visit them, who can't be with them. We're witnessing the suffering of patients from their lack of ability to connect and their ongoing fear and uncertainty about this virus. And we're collectively struggling with a lack of connection, anticipatory and complicated grief, and a lack of rituals to help us in moments of grieving. I think a term that I actually recently learned is the concept of disenfranchised grief, which is a type of grief we commonly experience in healthcare because it refers to grief that we're not in some way allowed to contend with publicly. So we as healthcare providers are taught to absorb the grief and suffering of others and not to necessarily look closely at how that affects us. I want to suggest that literature, both the reading and writing of it, can help. We have evidence that writing and journaling in med students' preclinical years actually helps with maintaining a sense of empathy for patients in later in their clinicals and throughout their careers. Journaling and writing is often used as in different forms of therapy. It really forces us to articulate what's in our heads to nobody but ourselves at first. If I asked everybody on this call to write one sentence about something you have recently grieved, and we shared our sentences with each other, I think you would undoubtedly find a person whose writing or voice echoed your own. Because the point of writing is to connect the personal and the universal. It's an incredibly powerful tool for us as individuals, but also deeply healing for us as a collective whole, particularly at these times, because it may be the ultimate form of connection during these disconnected times. And what writing forces us to do is to step away from the stiff upper lip and the performative parts of being a physician, particularly these days. It asks of us the opposite, which is not to be stringent and kind of very much in our heads and in our minds and focused on others. It asks of us to step back from all of that, and in true reflective and supportive writing, what I ask of people is to just start writing. Images, thoughts, phrases, they don't have to be complete sentences because we need to articulate what's in our minds. After, when we are grieving, we are left with questions and answers that we tell ourselves because we are desperately searching for explanations. But in the process of writing, we can step away from the need for an explanation and simply allow what has happened to be and learn to be with it. Yesterday, I took care of a patient who died of alcoholic liver disease and whose family was not able to visit. We had to have a devastating family meeting over Zoom, and when they came in and we transitioned to comfort care, I couldn't even hug them. This is perhaps the tip of the iceberg of my own experience with grief and loss and the witnessing of suffering of others and not knowing where to put the suffering I bear because of the combination of those factors. But I went home and I journaled, and it was a bunch of phrases, something like James Joyce, something like stream of consciousness. But telling the story to myself at first let me go on with my evening unburdened. Rituals are a sequence series of events performed at a given occasion, and they can be weddings or baptisms, funerals, or the tending of the dead body in a particular way. They give us a place to work out our most complex emotions. We don't have rituals in medicine to make space for grieving, to make space for connecting with each other, or just with ourselves over what we witness. I want to suggest that if hospitals and medical groups can try to develop rituals of writing, if individual physicians can start to develop rituals of writing, that may open a space for us to let out what we have been holding within for so long, not just in COVID, but in our entire careers. And I'm happy to take questions later. Thank you.
Thank you all. I am going to turn it back over to Alina for the next bit of the program on the call here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ungerleiter, and thank you to our guest speakers in this segment. I think this piece of the agenda was particularly powerful and important. And before we open up to questions from the lines, I'd like to invite my CMS colleagues to ask any questions or share comments with our presenters today.
Hi, this is Michael Lipp. I just want to take a moment to thank our guest speakers. Really powerful comments, and really appreciated the comments. And I was particularly interested in asking questions about the impact of telehealth, and particularly for patients with serious illness. And I heard some comments around one of the drawbacks of telehealth as being kind of the lack of having a tactile experience, lack of being able to do a full physical exam, but on the flip side, maybe balancing a power structure with patients and some of the efforts related to patients needing to get into the office, getting dressed, having family members take them. They may be unburdened with that. I'm curious about any thoughts on particularly older patients with serious illness, their ability to use the technology and comfort level with using it for these types of evaluations. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I can. Thank you, Michael. You know, I had the preconceived notion that older folks would somehow persistently resist acquisition of this and adoption of this topic. And while it's true that I think that there may be more resistance, I think that I can say pretty safely that the older patients and the folks that were most resistant to our transition to 100% telepalliative care delivery are also the people most enthusiastic about what it adds to their lives and experience, their quality of life. I think older folks are excited for things that really deliver those kinds of pragmatic improvements. The folks that it remains quite difficult to work with are folks that have a substantial cognitive impairment or lack someone to assist them with monkeying about with the gizmo itself. When you can add that assistance and support and walk them through it with good humor, almost universally, people recognize for themselves just experientially the advantages of connecting from the comfort of their home without having to travel. Older folks seem to be most excited about it, in my experience.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lipp. Other questions or comments from my CMS colleagues? Great. Operator, let's take some questions from the phone. Thank you.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you have questions, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, if you have questions, you may press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have questions, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. The first question is from Suresha Kopula of University of New Mexico. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Suresha Kopula. Thank you for all the information today. And I have a question regarding the home-based care. I know with the 1135 waiver, and the Hospital Without Borders, we are allowed to do more of that. What is, and with the hospitals trying to make use of that with the need for more beds out of the hospital as we are filling up the beds in the hospital, what is the likelihood of this continuing after the COVID, considering that this takes a lot of investment into the audiovisual devices as well as the home monitoring? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Do we have any of our CMS colleagues or subject matter experts who would like to address that? I'm happy to address it if not. Well, thank you for your question. We really appreciate you asking about our continued efforts to give the healthcare system unprecedented flexibility during this time. The agency is currently looking into
these flexibilities that we have offered. So we don't have any news that we can share with you today, but please do continue to receive our updates and visit the CMS website where you can find additional information. So thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have questions, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. The next question is from LaDawn Lynch of Gevidia Health. Your line is open.
Hi, I was calling in regards to the telehealth or listening in, and the advocate was very, in response to the telemedicine, that worked really well. But when the woman spoke about her writing, it's the lack of connection. The lack of connection is going to be missed if we call telehealth or somebody calls telehealth and they actually get different doctors that they get to call into. How do we know that we're going to get the same doctor that has done a physical on us that we've gone to for years, and then we get different people at different times? And if they don't know our case except what's being read off of what the last person actually put into the EMR system, that's going to now be everywhere. So I think my concern would be the lack of connection would definitely be that, especially with the older patients population. And then in regards to the pop-up tents or the little pop-up hospitals, majority of those weren't even used, and when they were used, I don't know about New Orleans, but I'm in Florida, they weren't even used, but they got to bill for those, and a lot of those staff members and the parking lots were empty because everybody was being sent home. But if we look at the impact of the allotments that everybody received for the COVID-19 funds that were paid out by CMS and everybody for these pop-up tents and telehealth equipment and services that they're providing, that's quite a bit of funds that are going back to the community health centers, rural health centers, and it's not going back to the patients that actually suffered from COVID-19. So I think the disconnect or the lack of connection with telehealth is definitely going to be there if we're going to get multiple doctors and there may not even be in our state.
I'm happy to respond to that, if that's okay.
Sure.
It turns out that health systems and delivery models all around the country have been rapidly adopting the use of telemedicine technology. And with that is not just the gizmos themselves, but a series of workflows that each of those organizations must use to fulfill the mission of their delivery model. So the kinds of continuity that you're asking for are highly valued by many, many health systems, whether in primary care, whether in specialty care, or in our organization in palliative care. So those kinds of disconnections are not intrinsic to the technology in any way. The people that our team sees have continuous and longitudinal relationships that stretch over months and sometimes even years for people that are seriously ill, as do in our local community, the primary care providers who I'm assisting in making these technologies serve their delivery model for primary care in a community clinic structure. So the technology itself does not interrupt any of those kinds of relational or continuity issues, and in fact in our practice it's actually enhanced our ability to stay connected to the same people with the same team.
But there are those the people in clinical trials, or are those in to, you know, are they calling the same, you know, if you're have the health insurance and I call the back of my number on my card, or somebody calls the back of their number on their card, are they guaranteed to get that? Are you guys have them as pilots or clinical trials, or testing these patients out to see how they'll do, educating them on stuff, just like the other person that chimed in? it is very difficult to get them to use, you know, this new technology and understanding how to actually do it. So one, are we going to get the same telehealth person every single time? Will they know me? I think that's going to be a major concern moving forward. But I appreciate all of your guys' time, and I'll just leave it at that.
And yeah, I just want to address real quickly, sorry, Michael, the comment about the pop-up unit. So just real quickly wanted to address that the pop-up unit that we initiated was really a hospice unit to provide care, end-of-life care to patients that were dying as a result of COVID. And our inpatient hospice unit, which was 15 beds, has been running at about 85% capacity since then. So we've had a significant amount of use come off of it. And we felt the resources that we put as an organization towards that were extremely well utilized.
Terrific. Thank you for your question and comment. We'll take our next question, please.
The next question is from Suzanne Clifford of Inspiring Transformation. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you so much. This has been very useful. We're actually creating a local health department as we speak, and so this is extremely helpful information. We really believe there's a lot more need for data and resources for end of life, and maybe it's out there and just hard to find, but as providers, hospice, families are making difficult decisions about end of life, the quality of life post-COVID is unclear. And so how do we collect data quickly so that we can help families and providers understand what is it going to take to be able to survive this, and what kind of quality of life could you face afterwards? And I know we can't predict and we don't know, but the more data we have for things like that so that families can make the decision to, you know, do we do a DNR? You know, what is the right decision at this point? And then also for both providers and families, are there some good journaling resources out there, or can the wonderful speaker that talked about that quickly create one that we can use? Thank you.
So I'm happy to take a stab at your questions. This is Sunitha Puri. First of all, certainly I can definitely send you some journaling prompts and resources that might really help your staff and your patients and families, whether they're dealing with COVID or not. I think secondly, regarding your question about how recovery from COVID looks like, so at our hospital at University of Southern California, our palliative care team actually auto-consults on every patient with COVID who enters the ICU. And we know that's a small fraction of all of the patients who get COVID in the United States, but what I've seen with recovery from COVID is that, first of all, time on the vent can be very variable, and we know that the longer you're on a ventilator and in the ICU, the harder your recovery is going to be. A lot of patients with COVID also have ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome, and recovery from that, from both a breathing and a functional standpoint, takes generally a long time. So I think, you know, and we have data out of Wuhan regarding CPR that shows that, you know, of one center there, only one person out of 136 patients survived CPR in the ICU. So generally speaking, I think some of the studies we have now, even if they're out of other countries or centers that take care of more sick patients, I think they're still useful in guiding discussions about CPR and ventilation. I don't know of any studies that have really looked at quality of life post-COVID for all comers per se, but I think at least our collective experience amongst the med centers in Southern California is that, number one, because this virus is still not totally understood. Some of our recommendations about decisions that could impact quality of life are really based on prior experience with things like acute respiratory distress syndrome and length of time in the ICU. Secondly, I think those, you know, families do ask what life is going to look like after COVID, and part of our role on palliative care is to help support their decision making through the extreme uncertainty that comes with this. Thirdly, I think what's always helpful in these discussions is to say that even though we don't exactly know what your quality of life is going to be, one of the things that you're always allowed to do is make different decisions than the ones you're making right now regarding your treatment if your quality of life with treatment is not where you want it to be. So I hope that helps. I think, you know, there's still so much uncertainty about how to guide decisions in the long term rather than in the short term admission to the hospital or ICU. But we do have a lot of data on recovery from being in an ICU, being on a vent, potentially being paralyzed because your oxygenation is so bad. And we can extrapolate from some of those data of post-ICU syndromes in particular to help guide patient decisions.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I'm really interested in, like, do oxygen levels impact cognition long-term and quality of life? And I know we're really early, but if we are going to have another wave of this, I think it's going to be important to figure those things out for family members whose loved one said, I want to have a good quality of life, or, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want to be here anymore. It's really hard to make those decisions with the data we have. And so I know we don't have a lot of the data that I want yet, but I hope some great researchers listening that can start to collect some of that wonderful data.
Totally agree.
Terrific. Thank you so much for your question. We will take our final question today. Thank you.
The last question is from David Baird, the Coalition to Transform Advance. Your line is open.
Terrific. Thank you. And thanks so much to all the speakers today and to the organizers of the call from CMS and the administration. So, you know, given that we've just heard, you know, from a number of different perspectives about how important it is now for patients, families, and providers to be having advanced care planning conversations in this environment, I wanted to kind of open it up and ask any of the speakers, but also those on the line from CMS, are there additional policy actions that CMS or other agencies might take to increase access to these conversations? You know, some really good work has been done so far. We at the Coalition to Transform Advanced Care, we're really pleased that advanced care planning is now going to be able to be reimbursed using audio-only means. So I'm just curious if anyone has thoughts about additional policy actions that could be taken to, you know, increase access or even socialize how important these conversations are right now in this environment. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your comment. I'd invite any of my CMS colleagues to address.
Hi, this is Michael Lipp. And so I appreciate the comments, and I think this would go along with some of the other flexibilities that we're kind of actively looking at in light of the pandemic and considering kind of post-pandemic, which of these we should consider moving forward with, or which would make more sense in the light of the PHE. But I appreciate the comments, and these are things that we're actively working on.
Perfect.
I can offer a few thoughts. I don't want to hog time, though. So really briefly, I think you're right that in order for advanced care planning discussions to be more widely done, there needs to be a cultural change in the community and a cultural change within medicine. We're just not taught how to have these discussions, and so palliative care specialists like myself and everyone else on the line, we're often called upon to help in moments of crisis. I think part of the cultural change needs to be that doctors and patients expect to have these discussions upstream, not in moments of crisis in the hospital, because that's generally what happens, at least in the healthcare systems I've worked in. So trying to find a way to normalize these discussions, the way we normalize domestic violence screening, for example, in the inpatient and outpatient setting, I think that needs to become an expectation that doctors will do and that patients are prepared for. I think that's going to be a very, very long process of change. So one thing that has worked here is that we have triggers for advanced care planning discussions that we offer, especially to outpatient oncologists and primary care doctors. So if patients meet certain criteria like new diagnosis of stage 3A, B, or 4 cancers, that's a trigger to have an advanced care planning discussion. And if it goes south, they can refer to our clinic. But I think part of what it means to do this well is to empower all physicians at all stages of training and practice on how to have these discussions, when to have these discussions, and to know that having these discussions doesn't mean, quote unquote, giving up. It means planning for all possibilities and managing uncertainty, which is really what I think truly that's healing for both physicians and patients.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for joining our call today. Another thanks to our tremendous guest speakers. As always, we appreciate you all finding time to connect with your peers and learn from one another as we address COVID-19 together. And in the meantime, you can continue to direct your questions or comments to our COVID-19 mailbox, which is covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. As always, please don't hesitate to reach us with any questions. Thank you again for all that you're doing for patients and their families around the country as we address COVID-19 as a nation. This concludes today's call. Have a great rest of your day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect. Have a good day.